In today's episode, we have Femi Olayebi, who is the Chief Creative Director at My World of Bags, a design and manufacturing company which produces a beautiful range of handcrafted products. Femi Handbags is a business line that produces bespoke leather handbags and accessories. Intervening on the podcast today, we have Abdusalam Kasim Baba, who is a graduate of mathematics from Usman Danfodio University in Sokoto and also an alumnus of the Faith Foundation AEP 68 program. Abdusalam is the creative director of AB The Shoemaker, a shoe manufacturing brand located in Kaduna. Join us as we listen to their journey on entrepreneurship in the Nigerian leather industry.
Beautiful morning to you, Ma.
Good morning, Abdusalam. It's so great to see you.
It's the pleasure is mine, Ma. You really have a beautiful space here, Ma.
Thank you.
So please, Ma, can you share with us how you started the journey of your entrepreneurship?
Okay, yes, I can. And it's been quite a while. I've been running this business for 27 years. I always count because my daughter is 27. And it started with making a baby bag for her. So in a nutshell, what happened was I was baby shopping and the last item on my list on my shopping list was a baby bag. So at the time, Tejo Shoe Market, the old Tejo Shoe Market was still there, and I had gone from Ibadan to Lagos to shop. So I rushed back into this Mother Care shop. At the time, Mother Care was a reigning brand. And all I could see, I can still visualize those bags today. They were made of rubber and they were very pastel-y colors. And I know that I'm not a pastel colored type of girl. So I thought, no, I'm not ready for these bags. So I came back to Ibadan and sat down and thought, why don't you make yours? And I could think that way because I had just learned how to use a sewing machine. And even going back, I know the reason I learned to use a sewing machine was because I was always using my hands to do something. You know, so, you know, you don't realize these things at the time, but obviously there was a creative streak in me. But who would have told me at the age of 16 or 17 or 19 or 20 that, oh, Femi, you're so creative, you know, you need to do things with your creativity. And so what did I do? So I went straight to the market here, Aleshaloye Market here in Ibadan, bought some pretty fabric and proceeded to make a bag, something I'd never done before. But logically, I thought, okay, a bag would have a long strap, it would have a base. So I cut out a round piece of cloth, I cut out a rectangle, and also and a long strip, and proceeded to sew. Yeah.
That's quite
so that was the starting point, really.
Wow. That's quite impressive. So taking us back to 27 years, I believe it's so much memory to you. And for someone like me that is just coming new into the leather industry, I'm just 3 years old in the industry.
Oh, you're such a baby.
I'm still a toddler. I've been opportunity to be mentored by you and some other good people in the industry. Let's take a little dive into the Nigerian leather industry. I am from the northern part of the country. I came from Kaduna. In the northern side of the country, we have a whole lot of animals' hide. And that is where some of the local tanneries are. Looking at that, Ma, but after getting those leather, we tend to export majority part of it out of this country for about 80% of it, if not more, out of this country, where they are being reprocessed and shipped back to the country for us, Ma, and we buy them at a very high expensive rate. What do you think we could do to reduce that, if not terminating it entirely? And because for so many other people like myself, it's kind of challenging. And so what do you advise the government to do to reduce that?
In order to answer your question, I'll go a bit way back in time. Okay, so my journey carries me through the years. And in 2010, I started out using denim and chinos. So really, I started out using cloth, but I also always used ashoke because I loved the vibrancy of the colors. And so in 2010, I happened upon my first international exhibition, which is called Pure London, and that was the biggest accessories show in London at the time. So that was the first time I was going to experience leather. And I found that leather was actually a very beautiful piece of material, you know, and I understood why the leather is associated with the word luxury. So I explored leather and found out little things like, okay, you cannot use the same needles that you use to sew a chino's bag to make a leather bag. You know, so I started discovering leather and then went for this exhibition and made the major mistake of my life. I didn't realize, and really those are the kind of lessons that I believe will come out during this conversation, that you know what, you need to be prepared. You know, so I go for this exhibition, I have all my beautiful leather bags there, and I bought most of the leather from Mushi Market in Lagos. And then I get buyers, international buyers, walk into my space, and they're like, okay, oh gosh, we'd like to have half a dozen of this, 10 of that. And I'm there happy and ecstatic that I've got my first international order. And then it's time to produce those bags. So I go back to Mushi Market and find that it's not possible. You just bought a scrap of leather and made this bag. And so there's not enough to make 6 or 10. And that's why I needed to go back so you can understand where we're coming from and where it is important that we eventually get to. And so I had great difficulty trying to source for those leathers. They just were nowhere to be found. What I discovered happens is the sellers in Mushi, in markets like Mushi, are dealing with warehouses that are manned by usually the Lebanese expatriates who have gone outside of the country to bring old season leathers. And when I say old season or last year's leathers that have been used by the designers. And so what comes back to us are basically lots of leftovers. Beautiful, good quality, because you know you can mingle through and find exactly what you want, but not enough to create products in multiples. So that was my first big lesson, that you do not go out into the international space if you're not ready with your raw materials. And when I say raw materials, I'm talking leathers and I'm talking accessories. And so I started this journey of discovery and found that the tanneries were there in Kano, that they had been about maybe 40 before, and that with everything else, there had been the depression and a lot of tanneries had closed down, and that there were maybe just about 4 to 6 good tanneries left. And the tanneries, of course, that are in business, are still in business because Nigeria happens to have maybe the best goatskin and the best lambskin in the world. And so they kill the lambs, they kill the goats, but for economic reasons, they send it all back out as crust. You know, so that's part of the process. So, you know, you kill, you salt, and then it becomes crust, and they sell the crust. And you say they sell 80%. They do not sell 80%. They sell 100%. And that's something I've really been passionate about. Because I find that when I started out, I was probably the only person, in 27 years ago, for goodness sake, there were not that many people making bags. And even when they did, they are no longer there making bags. But I stayed on. And so I followed this journey through and found that the challenges I was facing, even when I started in 2010 using leather, are still there today. And one of the bigger challenges, as you have said, is that the tanneries export all the leather. So we, the local markets, do not have access to those leathers because we are expected to buy a minimum of probably 500 square feet. And how many of us have those kind of markets that require us to buy 500 square feet of red goat skin, for example? So I think that, and again, I'm sure we'll talk about this later, because you know I don't want to talk about my passion like that, because the Lagos Leather Fair is close to my heart. You know, so I think that It's as simple as this. Policies need to come into place whereby the local market has to be represented. A percentage of what is going out has to come back, has to stay within, you know, and it shouldn't be all about the proceeds. And the government needs to work out, because I know that the more leather you sell, the more they have this grant, I think it's called the EEG grant or something, the more leather you sell, the more that comes back to you, the tannery, you know. So I think that they just need to sit down and come to the realization that, you know, there are many leather designers out there that need these raw materials. And it's okay to sell out there because they sell out in dollars, maybe $2.5 per square foot. You know, so how many of us have that capacity? So we need to sit down at the table and say to them, okay, you know what? You need to work out something for the local designers. We're shouting out from the rooftops and we can no longer be ignored.
So looking at all these challenges that you faced, was there any time you've thought about quitting?
That's an interesting question. And I get asked that a lot. But the answer is no. And I also wonder why. Why didn't I quit? When things were rough, when things were tough, why didn't I quit? I think that it's, again, it's a very simple answer. I absolutely love what I do. And I also have found out that those difficult seasons are a form of preparation for you. I didn't quit probably because I think it was something in my DNA. I think also the kind of background, the kind of parents I had, the kind of upbringing I had, you know, helped me stay on. My parents were, my dad is no more, but I had a father who was very passionate about what he did. So I think he definitely passed that passion on to me. And then he was also a very methodical person, you know, and he saw things through to the end. You know, so I think that's really part of it, you know. And I kept telling myself, you know what, girl, one day this thing is going to fix itself. Just keep at it, you know. So I think it's just the power of perseverance, the power of patience. You know, there is power in perseverance. There is power in being patient. I actually saw myself grow. I started out in my spare room, and then I moved to my garage. And then from my garage, I moved to the boys' quarters. From my boys' quarters, we moved houses, and I moved to the chalet behind my house. So I've always operated from home. But I wasn't going to let go. Even though you can't see where you're going to end it all up, you see that it's a growing concern. You see that there's so much that has come out of it. Even in spite of the negatives, there's been so many positives. And you're like, what? You know, this is what I was meant to do. I'm a translator by profession. And so I went off to school in Strasbourg because I really wanted to be translating. You know, I wanted to be a high-flying translator working at the UN, you know, with a nice red sports car. You know, so that was a dream I had for myself. But, you know, the universe knew otherwise, and this is how I ended up. So I think that it's just loving what you do. I think that is so important, and not considering it as work as per se, that made me keep at it, and knowing that I could see myself not going down but going up gradually, you know. So it was a slow process, but I never stopped moving.
So let's look at the leather firma. Mm-hmm. So what inspired the initiative for the Lagos Leather Firma?
I always answered that question with the word frustration. You know, I had reached a stage where I was totally frustrated with what was going on, or rather what was not going on, as the case might be. And I had experienced so many things, you know, so many disappointments, and I just felt that something needed to be done. I also found that in a country like ours, we do a lot of talking. With all due respect to the talkers, we do a lot of talking, but not a lot of doing. And for about 5 years before the leather fair, I had sat down many times. I had made calls to, I've never been to Kano, interestingly, and I've never been to Aba. And these are two key pivotal points in the country, especially when it comes to leather. But I did study a lot about what was going up there. I made a lot of phone calls. I explored a lot about what was going on in these areas. And I found that we actually have all the tools at our fingertips. And then I think it was in 2012 or 15, I can't remember the exact year, when I read a World Bank report saying that, which indicated that if it was well executed, if everything was put in place, that the Nigerian leather or the leather space, leather as it were, and related leather products could easily become Nigeria's best earner of foreign exchange after oil and gas. And I thought, wow, what are we doing wrong? And I started studying other countries like Ethiopia, which is another African country. They are cattle rearing. They're also a cattle rearing country. And I found that they had gone way ahead of us. They were already exporters of beautifully finished leather goods, where we were not. You know, the fact that we're exporting 2 bags or 3 bags or 10 bags or 20 bags doesn't make us an exporting country in leather. Having said that, in Aba, they were exporting 500,000 bags or leather products a day. You know, but there's a difference between what was happening in Aba and what was happening in spaces like ours. So I decided, well, since nobody was going to listen to me, I had sent out proposals to some government agencies. I thought, just do it. Take this thing and run with it. Take this idea of yours and run with it. And the reason I wanted to do that was to make people sit up and listen. So I decided it wasn't something I could do by myself. I needed to bring the players along that supply chain into one space, because this was an ecosystem that needed some recognition. And the other thing that made me do it was there was a lot going on in the fashion space. And everybody seemed to be talking about fashion. And I wondered, everybody, each and every one of us has a shoe or a wallet or a bag, a leather product. No one leaves their house without one leather product. And I'm, okay, thank you for that piece of information. You know, so I thought, so there's something wrong here. You know, something needs to be done about it. So I'm not going to try and squeeze into the fashion space. I'm going to ensure that leather gets the recognition that it deserves. And I'm just going to give it a shot. If it works, fine. If it fails, fine. I would have tried. But it would not have been for lack of trying. So I sat down, created this thing in my head, came up with the name, the Lagos Leather Fair, called my office and asked them to buy the domains up, and started shouting, the Lagos Leather Fair.
Quite interesting, Ma. So why Lagos Leather Fair per se? Why not Nigerian Leather Fair? Or do we see the fair, is the fair just remaining in Lagos? Because people from the north actually have little knowledge or no knowledge about the leather fair happening in Lagos, just for a few of us that are aware about the fair. So are we looking at this fair going to places like Abuja, Aba, just like you said, Kano, those key players of leather in Nigeria, Ma?
Well, okay, it's again, in thinking up a name for the fair, we wanted to be very careful, because even though the dream is to have the collection of designers, producers of finished leather goods, suppliers of hardware come into Lagos for that event, we do still expect that people will come from all over Nigeria for that event. Lagos is the commercial hub of the country. So it was important that we situated it. I'm based in Ibadan, so I could have had the fair in Ibadan, but I knew that it would not work. I knew that Lagos is a central point where everybody sort of zooms into. You know, it's a collection point. It's a melting pot where everything happens. You know, so for me, it had to be Lagos. Also, I wanted to equate that fair with what was happening in the international space. And so I looked at the other international leather fairs, and they're always situated in the capital cities. So you have the fair, the leather fair in Dubai. You have the leather fair in Istanbul. So you have leather fairs all over the world. And I had attended many fairs in Milan, which is also a very the fashion hub of Italy. You know, so I realized that I wasn't going to call it the National Leather Fair, because that was not, it would give it a different connotation. It's something that we expect as we go along to become actually international. And so when you think in the Lagos Leather Fair, you're thinking of events like the Milan Fashion Week, the New York Fashion Week, the Istanbul Leather Event. You know, so that's exactly where I thought it should be placed. And so I'm not quite looking at the geography of it for convenience reasons. It's actually because we know that it's a fair that's going to blow up. This year, for example, we have international designers going to take part in the fair. And so we also want that fair to come to be part of the international calendar. This is our third edition, hopefully by next year. We'll have people from Milan, people from all over the world attend and mark their calendars, knowing fully well that there's a need to attend the Lagos Leather Fair because there's so much happening there. So really, that's it. That was the reason.
From your explanation about the leather fair, that says a lot of why your showroom too is located in Lagos, ma. So who are the main people your products are targeting, ma?
Okay, yes, it's interesting again, because even though I love working in Ibadan, I know that I could never, unless maybe when I do become that billionaire that I'm dreaming to become, have a space like this in Lagos. It would cost me several arms and legs. You know, so in Ibadan, there's the space to dream. Where in Lagos, every time I come to Lagos, I'm sitting in traffic, I'm missing appointments. It's just a crazy life out there. Even though there's so much energy in Lagos. I love Lagos too. But I love Lagos in bits and pieces, you know, just little droplets of Lagos is fine for me. So it's worked out for me really to have my operational space in Ibadan, have my office in Ibadan, have my factory in Ibadan, and have people who have been working with me. The tailor that's been, my oldest tailor has been working with me for 20 years.
Wow.
I don't know that would necessarily have happened in Lagos. Because there's something about Lagos that everybody wants to be out there, you know. But again, maybe the difference here is there's more of a sense of contentment and commitment among that cadre of people that work for you. So I'm quite happy working here and very, very happy having my outlet in Lagos, because I know that I do not necessarily have my target market here in Ibadan. They do exist, but the target market, and what's my target market? Who's my customer? My customer is the banker, the middle class, from middle class to maybe an HNI, high net worth. And I've discovered that over time, you know, and that brings me to, it's very important to know who your customer is. You know, again, it's a lesson I learned as I went along, because sometimes you're not even able to define who your customer is until you experiment and you find, okay, this particular category of persons are not buying from me, why are they not buying from me? And this particular segment of persons is quite happy to buy without necessarily negotiating, you know. And as time grew, I always knew that I wanted to sell high end to whatever the definition, the Nigerian definition of high end is. But again, I needed to also discover that by experimenting and discovering that, okay, they were ready to pay the price that I was asking for my products. And so when I finally came to that conclusion, and I think I came to that conclusion about 5 years ago, I knew exactly who my target customer is. And I knew that Lagos was where I could place a shop where I knew that I could get a customer walk in and buy my pieces, you know, on a continuous basis. And so that's it.
Interesting and informative, ma. You made mention that your oldest tailor is working with you for over 20 years or close to 20 years, ma. Please, can you share a little with us that are just 13? How have you been able to keep somebody for that long? That's quite interesting, because most craft people have attitude. Once you find a craftsman that is good, he has bad attitude to the work. And once you find the one with good attitude, he is bad. He's not really good with the work. Mm-hmm. So how did you manage to win their trust and loyalty?
Okay, so when I started out, I was actually hiring dressmakers, because at the time, I did not even realize that there was such a thing as leather craftsmen. You know, so I started at a time when I didn't know how to Google. I mean, I'm talking 27 years. Some people were not even born. How old are you? So I started out just feeling my way myself. So I would go out and look for people who knew how to use a machine. And as time went on, and I discovered that there were certain things that you needed to do differently when it came to sewing a bag, as opposed to sewing something like you were wearing, I started teaching them what I had sort of taught myself. And so Nigeria 20 years ago is different from the Nigeria of today. The youths, if I can call them that, are different today. We have a totally different breed. And I'm just wondering where they dropped from. They're phenomenally different from then. So I've used the word a sense of contentment in the course of this conversation. And I think there was more of that then. But today, there's this get-rich-quick factor which is pushing not just the youth, actually, but, I mean, quite a huge percentage of people. So it's in knowing that your staff are your internal customers. And that's something that I've always kept right at the forefront of anything that I do. That if all, and I say to them, that if all of them were to walk out on me today, I really wouldn't have a business. So the first thing is to treat them like they're human beings. And I think that it was easy for me to do that because of my background. I've come from a background where I have strict parents, but very kind, humane parents. So I didn't come from a home where there was shouting down on the staff, you know. I didn't come from, so I think seeing that and growing up like that just made me realize that it's important to treat your staff right. That doesn't mean mollycoddling them, but it means balancing things with them, you know. It's important to be interested, to show that you are interested in their livelihoods, to show that what happens to them matters to you. To show that, yes, you might be the boss, but you're not in this glass castle that they don't have access to. So they always had access to me, you know. And so they felt comfort in that, in knowing that. In fact, when we moved here, I think they became scared that there was going to this office, this nice, you know, glass office was going to create a distance between myself and them. So in dealing with them, I had to sort of reassure them that I was still there for them, you know. So I think it's that, and also the fact that for some reason, even though they will misbehave, I was always looking for ways to make them happy. Because at the end of the day, it's all about that, you know. So I would give them lunches, you know, it was just part, even though it cost me, it was a bit of sacrifice, but I know that the day we decided that we were going to give lunches, a lot changed, you know, and it just sort of, you know, it gives them, it boosts them. Yeah, it motivates them. And so there's a lot of that going on. And so I think it's just being able to build that relationship, you know, and make sure, let them know that there's a bridge and that you can walk across that bridge and I'm there for you. You know, so there's that. So we do a lot of that. Again, last year, I think it was last year, 2 years ago, we also decided that, okay, you know, there's a lot of the NHS, even though I'm not doing it the NHS way, but again, we signed up at a hospital, and they know that if they have something as simple as malaria, there's a place to go to, you know, so they're all signed up, all my staff are signed up at the hospital, and so there's a certain comfort. I've built a canteen for them, so they're quite happy during their 1 hour break, you know, so they do misbehave, trust me, you know, but you will not then be that inhuman person or that ogre that says, okay, you know what, they don't amount to anything anyway, so you're not going to, no, you just have to keep, but just make sure that there's that balance, you know.
Wow, this is really interesting. Okay, Ma, I want you to share a little bit with us what's the way forward for those that are just starting, that can't really afford those luxuries of keeping those staff, just the way you say, the youth. The reason why I'm key on this is part of the problem I'm facing currently,
yeah.
The way the ideology of the youth wants to get rich overnight, and loyalty, money is where they are loyal to, wherever they see money, and for starters like myself that don't have much money to offer, what advice will you share with us on keeping them in regards to this man?
Okay, you know, when I started out, trust me, I was just like you. I wasn't any richer. It's not like my dad said, oh, you know what? Hey, you're starting a business. All right, so here's a pot of gold. There was no such thing. You know, so again, 20-something years ago is different from now. The values are totally different. The way the society has metamorphosed is frightening. You know, so I guess a lot of younger ones are looking at a lot of people up there, maybe in government, in places, in high positions, and saying, oh my God, you know, they're driving this, they're living in these amazing houses, they're driving all these huge jeeps, and then they want to be, and they aspire to be like them. So I think that that's where we've got it all wrong, and we don't have the right role models. And so people like myself that are not necessarily out there, I was just telling, I didn't get to do that, I'm not a diva. All I do is get up, dress up, and show up, and work hard, which is what I've done all these years. We need to recondition. I don't know how that's going to happen, though. We need to almost unlearn the bad habits and learn those habits that our parents and grandparents passed down to us, that good things take time, and that there's no such thing as overnight success, and that when you're looking at a Femi handbags and saying, oh my gosh, she's got this amazing office, it was a lot of preparation. It did not happen overnight, but nobody sees that. Nobody sees the time when I sat on my stairs and cried. Nobody sees the time when I struggled to put money together just to go for that show, you know, so that I could learn more. We're preparing for the Lagos Leather Fair now, and we found somebody on Instagram. Instagram, of course, has not helped. Everybody wants to be a diva. Everybody wants to be Instagram, an Instagram, what do you call it? Yes, hero. You know, everybody wants to be a hero. Everybody wants to be out there. You know, so Instagram hasn't helped as much as, for me, Instagram is the God's gift to entrepreneurs, because it's a free platform to advertise your product. However, it has its downsides. And I find that a lot of people are there on Instagram wanting to be like a Wizkid or a David O, you know. But you know what? That's not all there is to Instagram. There's still so much more. I find that today everybody wants to be a makeup artist. And I just wonder, what happened? How did everybody suddenly want to become? There's nothing wrong in that. But the question I ask is, 5 years down the line, what are you still going to be doing? You know, so I think that we've lost a lot of direction. I don't know if it has to do with the education. I don't know what it has to do with. I've tried to understand why the youths have this self, this sense of entitlement, because they seem to do. Now, I'm not saying 100% of the youths do, because I have three daughters who definitely do not have a sense of entitlement. Again, why not? Maybe because they've seen me. I used to paste their school fees on the fridge then. So you see how much we have to pay to get you to these good schools. So you've got to work hard. You know, you can't not work hard. Nobody's going to put anything on your plate just like that. You need to be able to grow up and buy your own tickets if you want to travel. I did it. I wasn't going to wait for any parent to do it for me. I did it myself. You know, so, and today I reap those rewards, but nobody, like I said, sees, you know, so they need to step back a little. They need to understand, and I love what the Faith Foundation is trying to do with this. I think that, like she said, there are a lot of stars out there, but there are also a lot of unsung heroes. We need to hear their stories. We need to pull you people back and say, these are the way that things are done. You know, you don't have to start today and make it tomorrow. It's not going to happen because you will burn out. Also, in terms of trying to hire staff, you don't even have to hire many. You know, you can start with one and then grow slowly. You know, because it's in growing slowly that you build that solid base. If you wake up today and decide you want to be like me tomorrow, you will burn out. You don't have to write that anywhere. You will burn out. Steps need to be taken, and it's better to start slowly and grow incrementally, you know, like grow vertically, like they say, you know, start from the bottom up and learn. You need to seek knowledge, because it's important that you know you're a master in your industry. It's not just about making a leather product. You need to understand even how the leather works, because there's a way leather itself works. So it's important to read, understand your industry, know who your target customer is, and don't look on the other side of the fence at the person that has succeeded, because you have to be passionate about something anyway. And a lot of younger ones are going into the wrong professions until they discover that, oh, this was really not meant for me and it didn't work. So there's a lot of self-discovery that needs to be going on, a lot of self-exploration. Know yourself and push on from there.
Wow, that's quite interesting. So I'm talking about knowledge. What do you think our schools or the curriculums should be included into this, so as to help these younger ones understand about this? And looking at that, what advice would you have for the younger generations that wants to venture into the leather industry?
I know that we were all sent to school to learn maths and English and geography and history, but the world has moved. The world has changed. And what our country has done is sort of not move along with the flow. And you find that there's still a lot of emphasis on paper certificates and all that, which is great. It's okay to have those paper certificates. It's also better to ensure that those paper certificates will be there, framed up in your homes. But how do you make a life for yourself? It is in acquiring skills. You can't beat the acquisition of skills. And in our Nigeria today, the reason why we will still bring in engineers from China and all those places to build our roads is because all we've done is gone to engineering school, learned engineering, but not learned the practical side of it. And so that is what is missing in our curriculum. I'm not saying we should go to school to learn to be carpenters or leather crafters. No, I'm saying that we need, although some people are doing it today, but I still don't think it is enough. We need those vocational courses. We need to add it. We need to not let it just be like something that's written down nicely just to satisfy all, you know. It needs to be taken seriously. I have a lot of friends who say, I love what you're doing. I just envy you. And I'm wondering, why do you envy me? I'm sweating it out, and you know. But I think they have seen for a long time, they saw what I didn't see. God has deposited something inside of me, and I was using my talent. And I find that a lot of people have not even discovered their talent. And so within the leather industry, there is so much that can still be done, you know. So the reason why we don't have leather crafters here, and the reason why a lot of you young people, or even my contemporaries, beat a path to Lekki Market, the Lekki craft market in Lagos, is because over there you find the Malians, you find the Senegalese, you find the Francophones doing this work at a level at which us Nigerians have not reached. Why has that happened? It has happened because they took this craft up from maybe when they were 10, and they did it consistently over time, you know, and then they took over their father's skills, they learned those skills, and so today they are so adept at it that it is a part of their DNA. But for us, we just want to quickly learn for 2 weeks and think, oh my God, me too, I can train. Which brings me to what the Nigerian Export Promotion Council has done. After the leather fair, we formed a partnership with the Nigerian Export Promotion Council to train, because they also recognized the fact that there was a need to train. There were all these people in the leather space, you know, and they needed to train. So we formed this partnership, and you are one of the beneficiaries, and it's awesome that you're here today. And I know that you've grown, because we follow up with our trainees. I know, yeah. So we train them, right? And what do we train them on? It's a 2-week training. We call it intensive. And I know a lot of you go away with a different mindset. Because on our first day of training, all we do is, we call it the thinking day. Think, how can you be innovative? How will I make a product that's different from the next person? Because everybody is doing the same thing. And the reason is because we're not doing enough research and development. And then you finish the 2-week training. And then what else? You're still struggling to find somebody to make your bags, which is where the big problem is. That value chain, there are many chinks. If you try and imagine it as a metal chain, there are many chinks in that chain. So it starts from the idea, right, to the finished concept. And in between, there is so much. To come up with that final product, you will need to come up, like I said, with the idea, then you need to visualize that pattern in your head. In civilized countries, you have pattern makers. You have people who actually do nothing but design for you. So you call them designers. You have people who build prototypes. You call them prototype makers. Then you have people who manufacture the prototypes, sample makers. You have those. Then from the samples, you take it back to the designer. The designer looks at it, approves, makes modifications, and then you have the producer who does a final production for you. And even inside all that, you have those people who provide metalware, hardware. You need magnetic clasps, you need bag feet, you need zippers. But I find that middle is just one big mesh. There's nothing happening in there. Everybody wants to be a designer. Everybody wants to be a CEO. And I just wish that we would come to that point where we say, you know what? Why can't I just be a pattern maker? Why can't I put it out there? There are more than enough leather designers in this space. And if I offer them this, last year's leather fair, we brought in a guy who I just discovered. He was like a treasure. He has this huge CNC machines. And what does he do? He cuts. His name is Zuki. Yeah. He always calls me and tells me that the leather fair was the best thing that happened to him. Because when he got there, he found that a lot of people could outsource the cutting of their leather pieces to him. So if you have 100 bags, you don't need to cut up 100 bags. Just take them, take your leather, hand it over to this gentleman, and his machine would click, cut, click, cut, click, cut. And in minutes, you have your 100 pieces there. That is part of what I'm talking about. We need to learn to outsource parts of those tasks, those processes, you know, and concentrate on our own God-given talent. That's the only way. So if we don't pull together as a force and do things together, we're not going to move forward, and we're not going to get to that commercial level production that is going to make us an exporting country. And really, exporting is the only way forward.
Thank you.
I should also ask you a few questions because you were part of the training.
Yes.
And I would like to know, even though we followed you, I'd like to know, how did that training impact you from before you arrived? What difference has it made from before you arrived and after the 2 weeks?
Actually, when I came for that training, I didn't actually attend the training because I wanted to make bags. Because I was just interested because it's related to leather, and yeah. I'm a fan of leather, I love leather. So I came, and one of the things I took from that training that I use till today is what you and Sir TJ always tell us: pay attention to details. And believe you me, when I went back, I paid attention to every piece. Every piece carrying my logo or my name on it, it's an intentional product from my brand.
Yeah.
Because that is one thing I have learned from you. And where God buttered my bread was where Faith Foundation 2 came in to show me how to sell those products.
Yeah.
By using the AEP program. I attended a 1 month AEP program with Faith Foundation, and I learned a lot. And it has been part of my growth process. And that is why most people see me like I am growing way faster. But I understood it because of mentorship and programs like this that have left me up a little bit. So it was really, really impactful. Thank you.
That's amazing. I mean, I'm glad, because the idea is, of course, is to impact people like yourselves. So now that you are actually making the products, and can I ask you, how are you making the products? Are you making the products yourself, or are you outsourcing the production?
I have a team. I have 5 permanent workers, 5 temporary, and 6.
Oh wow! Hey, good for you. Yeah. Okay.
So we work together as a team, and I always sit them down, talk to them, and because I believe mentorship is the way forward, just how you said, we can't make it overnight. And just how we have role models, people we look up to, but there is a need for us to still look at how they got to where they are. Just how you said, when I came here this morning, I was so inspired and I was so motivated, and I told myself, fine, this is very beautiful, but it took her 27 years. I'm going to take a tip or two from her today so that mine won't take me up to 27 years, but I will surely get there with time. So that's the important role mentorship and programs like this have really helped in our businesses, man.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear that. And basically what you're also trying to, what I'm getting from all this, from my story and hopefully yours, because I hope that in 5 years time you would also be asked to come and share your story. What I get from all of this is that sacrifices need to be made, you know, and when people say, or young up and coming entrepreneurs say, you know, I don't have the money, I can't afford it, I think that we should step away from that.
Yes.
And stop making money that king, because, you know, it's what you want for yourself.
Yes.
If you want something, I mean, I've been to sessions where people come in, wrap their baby behind them.
Definitely.
And, you know, I'm very impressed by that, because it's like, come rain, come shine, I must be at this event, you know.
Yes.
Because I know I'm going to learn. It's not about money. Money can't pay for these things. And you've also said it, you know, paying attention to detail, because there's a lot of mediocrity around. So in building our brands, it's important that we sit down and understand. It's important that we research. We shouldn't be in a hurry. You know, it's not about selling that one bag today, which is something I always told myself. And we also must understand that there's a huge difference between a brand and a product. A product is that thing that you can touch. It's tangible. A brand It's something that you cannot touch. So we all need to get to that stage where, even though you don't see it physically, you can hear it, you can smell it, and you know. So even me, in creating my store in Lagos, it's all about the five senses. You know, you walk in, there's a way the shop must smell, there's a way the shop must look, you know, because it's all in seconds. We only need seconds to make that first impression, and I think that's what a lot of us must work at. You know, we mustn't be in a hurry to succeed. You know, it's not about us. If God wants us to succeed, we will. You know, let's just do the hard work and take the necessary steps. As long as we don't stop moving, we don't stop learning, we don't stop acquiring those skills, we'll get there.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you for having this conversation. It's lovely to have you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Journeys in Entrepreneurship. This interview was recorded on the 19th of July 2019 at the Femi Handbags head office in Ibadan. Journeys in Entrepreneurship's executive producer is Adenike Adeyemi. Our technical producer and director is Elo Iyamu. This series was reviewed by Miriam Adeoti, Feishaya Shogbeson, and Loretta Ihel-Mere. The artwork and design was done by Kingsley Effiong, while the video production and editing was by UVisual. The theme song for this series, which you're also listening to now, was put together by Tani and Shemilore Oludipe. To watch videos of this recording, please visit faithfoundation.org/podcast and also the Faith Foundation YouTube channel. Remember to join us next week, Friday, for an all-new episode. Thank you.